What's going on, Warrior Soul Nation? This is Chris Albert, and welcome to episode number 74. And it is now 2018. As we get into this new year, it's good to remind ourselves of something that often comes up as a theme in this podcast, and that is that you are the author of your own story. You know, at the beginning of the year, we always hope for these really good things to happen to us. And we have these New Year's resolutions. We tell ourselves that we're going to train more. We tell ourselves that we're going to eat better. We tell ourselves that we're going to save money. But things always happen. Bad things will happen to everybody. It's just the way life is. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what happens to you. What matters is how you respond to it. What you're going to do next. Are you going to give up because something didn't go your way? Are you going to give up because of a tragedy? Or are you going to grit your teeth? And are you going to move forward? And are you going to grab life by the balls and say, this doesn't define me, and this is not going to define the rest of my life? The individual I have on the episode today is Rob Jones. Rob served as a United States Marine, and he was deployed both to Iraq and Afghanistan. And on his deployment to Afghanistan, while he was serving as a combat engineer, he had both of his legs blown off above the knee. And I'm very sure that Rob faced many dark moments during that time. But Rob wasn't going to let the fact that he didn't have legs anymore define him. What he did was he decided that he was going to live his life doing extraordinary things. And so Rob's actually done some things that a lot of us with all of our legs and or both of our legs and all of our appendages honestly couldn't do or wouldn't think of doing. He rode a bike from the state of Maine to the state of California in the cold, I might add. He just completed 31 marathons in 31 days, and he's competed in rowing the highest level at the U.S. on the U.S. team for the Paralympics. And I mean, this guy is absolutely amazing. So I wanted to bring him on to talk about his story, to talk about his mindset, and to talk about what drives him to this day. And I hope that all of you get a whole heck of a lot out of this, because I know I did. Before we get into the conversation, I just want to give you a quick note from our sponsors, F-Bomb Nutrition. They're at www.fatissmartfuel.com. They make some amazing, awesome, delicious packets of fat. Now, I'm always talking about the benefits of a high-fat diet, and Rob even talks about how he used a high-fat diet for his training, for his 31 marathons in 31 days. But, you know, a lot of times it's hard to get sources of fat when you're out and about and you're on the road. And F-Bomb, they've got this covered. And yeah, they have some packets of some amazing oils like avocado oil, coconut oil, and MCT oil. What I really like are their fuel packets. And a really awesome recipe that I made up today. I couldn't eat today. I had to go through a whole bunch of meetings. I was in meetings from about 9 a.m. all the way up until about 6 p.m. straight. So in the morning before my first meeting, what I did was I took a packet of their macadamia nut butter, chocolate, and sea salt. And I took a little coconut oil and I blended it up into a cup of coffee with a little bit of ghee butter. And not only did I not get hungry throughout the day, I had absolutely amazing energy. and their fuel packets with the macadamia nut butters in it, they're absolutely delicious. Tastes like a crushed up cookie without the sugar in it, in a little packet that you can carry around with you. So definitely check them out. Great company, and they're great people too. They have a lot of support for veterans in the veteran community. And for our listeners here at Warrior Soul, if you use the code Warrior Soul at checkout, you'll get 20% off your first order. So go check them out at www.fatissmartfuel.com. They're also at www.dropanfbomb.com. And with that, I'm going to stop yapping my gums over here, and let's get into this episode with Rob Jones.
This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's a solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And we need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason: to live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is Chris Albert, and today we have the privilege of bringing Rob Jones onto the show. And Rob is an absolutely amazing individual. And one of the things that I've learned over the past few years, just going through the ins and outs of life, going through the trials and tribulations of entrepreneurship, going through some of my own personal battles, is that I've taken inspiration from some of the words of long ago. You know, when I read about the Stoic philosophers, they say that it's not what happens to you in this life, it's how you respond to it. And one of the things you have to remember is that you're always the author of your own story. So anything that happens to you, that it's up to you to decide what is going to happen for the rest of your life and where you're going to take it from there. And we'll let Rob talk about his story a bit. But first, Rob, welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast.
Thanks a lot, man. It's a pleasure to be here. And I appreciate you letting me come on and tell my story.
Definitely. It's awesome to have a fellow Marine here. Can you talk about how it started? You know, when did you decide to join the Marine Corps?
I decided to join the Marine Corps in 2006 in my junior year at Virginia Tech. I just recently realized that computer science wasn't for me. And so I started looking for what else I could do, you know, what was my missing in my life. And I had a friend that had joined the Marine Corps the year before. And so I started looking into what the heck the Marine Corps was and what it was all about. And I read the book Brotherhood of Heroes about the Battle of Peleliu in World War II. And reading that just made everything click, you know, everything in that book and what those guys went through clicked with me. And, you know, I realized from reading that what I needed. I needed some brotherhood. I needed some courage, some altruism in my life. And so I think maybe probably the next day or maybe even that afternoon after finishing, I went down to the recruiter's office and I was sworn in, you know, within the week.
It's amazing because I think the greatest recruiting tool that the Marine Corps has are all the stories and the books that are out there. When I read right before I joined, I read a book called Boot, and it was about Marine Corps boot camp. Just as I'm finishing the last page of the book, Marine Corps recruiter calls my house. Like, the timing couldn't have been more perfect. And I ended up going down and signing that day. So I think there's so many people with those kinds of stories. That and those of us who got taken by the guy defeating the dragon.
Yeah, I think what the Marine Corps has the lowest recruiting budget, but the highest recruiting numbers, or the best recruiting numbers or something. But maybe they have the best recruiting numbers with respect to their budget or something like that. But it's definitely, they have a totally different approach from all the other branches. They're, instead of asking, you know, or telling people, you know, what they'll get from joining the Army or the Air Force, the Navy, whatever, the Marine Corps gives you an opportunity to see what you can give to it. So it's definitely a different approach, and that was definitely attractive to me.
Definitely. So you get through boot camp and you became an engineer, right? Why'd you decide on the engineers?
I just kind of fell into it, actually. My original plan was to join the reserves and finish my last year at Virginia Tech, and then apply to officer school, OCS. And then so I joined as a reservist, and it just so happened that the reserve unit that I was going to be assigned to was Combat Engineer Unit, Bravo Company, 4th Combat Engineer Battalion. And the only billets they had available were Combat Engineer billets. So, you know, I was just assigned there, assigned the job. But, you know, looking back on it, I'm supremely thankful that I got that job, because it was, you know, can't imagine doing something better. So
it's awesome. Were you part of the Corps of Cadets over there at Virginia Tech or anything like that? Or did you have any inkling of joining prior to that? Or
no, I just joined the reserves, and I was just going to graduate and then apply to OCS. I didn't really have any interest in doing the Corps of Cadets, just because I would have to do. I didn't even know what the process would be of, you know, joining after my junior year. So I just decided just to do the reserves. But I never ended up becoming an officer, because my unit was accepting volunteer platoon for Iraq, like right after I graduated. So I never got the chance.
So you ended up going to Iraq first, and you went on a deployment there, a lot of us, you know, we think of engineers. I think when I think of engineers, I think of heavy loads, carrying a lot of weight. I think of the guys who are out front clearing the way for us, clearing the road of hazards and clearing the road of explosive devices. Was that what you were doing out there?
Yeah. So there's three different facets to combat engineering. There's doing stuff with the air wing, so airport stuff, runways, that kind of thing. And there's the construction aspect to it, where you're kind of building bunkers and building up forward operating bases and, you know, being out there in the field and establishing these things. And then there's what I did, which was essentially emplacement and defeat of obstacles. So we didn't really place a whole lot of obstacles. We would, build up the forward operating bases we established, but we were primarily dealing in defeating obstacles. So anything that got in our way, whether it be a doorway or a mud wall or some trees or whatever, we would blow it up and get it out of there and then move on. And then so also we had the IED threat that we were responsible for, because that is another obstacle. It's something that makes the foot mobile people have to pause and defeat. So that job naturally came to us. And so, yeah, we'd be out there. There's route clearance, which is they use all the vehicles, specialized vehicles, and they would clear roads. And then what I did was I would be attached to infantry platoons and squads. And anytime they came to a place where there could be an IED or a high likelihood of there being an IED, I would go out and clear a route through that danger area, and then they would follow me.
And so on this first deployment you went to Iraq, was there a lot of stuff going on where you were? Were you pretty busy there?
2008, Habani, Iraq was very quiet. We didn't really have to worry a whole lot about IEDs. There was one IED strike that did kill two guys, but the IED threat there wasn't very high. And so we actually spent most of our time going out and finding old weapons caches that the local populace would tell us about. And so, you know, not exactly what I had envisioned for going to war, but at the same time, I'm proud of that mission, because I think we made Iraq a safer and better place through what we did. But, you know, as a Marine, I wasn't totally satisfied because I didn't get to try and kill somebody.
Yeah, I absolutely know that feeling. And, you know, for so many of us, there's a lot of people out there, a lot of Marines out there, a lot of members of all the services who, you know, they have these kind of like anticlimactic deployments where you go through the deployment, nothing really happens. You come back, people are thanking you and you're like, what the heck did I do? And then that was kind of my feeling on the whole situation when I got back from my deployment, because I faced absolutely nothing when I was in Iraq. I definitely understand that feeling of where you're coming from and kind of having some unfinished business there.
Well, I think it's less about, I think what people are really thanking you for is not exactly what you actually did, but more along the lines of what you were willing to do. If you had gotten into a situation where you need to go into combat, then you would have, and you would be willing to do that or die for whatever purpose or die for whoever you needed to die for. And so I think what they're really thanking you for is that, as opposed to the specific experience that you had.
No, absolutely. I'm just saying in my own head, it's kind of like this thing that, you know, I had a long time. It took a long time for me to get around that in my own head. And I think a lot of people deal with that. A lot of people who have served deal with that in their own heads. I take nothing away from thanking any service member. I just think, you know, for a lot of us who've been in that situation, it's what I said, anticlimactic, you know.
You go over there expecting one thing and wanting kind of in a way one thing. And when you don't get it, it can be a tad disappointing in a certain way.
Absolutely.
That's why whenever Marines like meet another Marine that has ribbons on, they check for the combat action ribbon first. It's like that badge of, whatever. But, I'm sure you agree with this, and I'm sure everybody else agrees too. That's like, you know, it's just a matter of circumstance, whether or not you are a part of a huge battle or nothing happens. So, you know, it doesn't really make a difference, I don't think.
Absolutely. 100%. 100%. So you got back and, then another deployment came up and you volunteered for that. And you ended going to Afghanistan that time, right?
Yeah. So that was 2010. We got back from the Iraq deployment. Like I said, wasn't satisfied. But even if I had been satisfied, I think I probably still would have volunteered for that deployment as well, because that was just what I was in the Marine Corps for. I had signed up for 6 years, and I intended to spend as much of that 6 years as possible, you know, fighting alongside other Marines. So I volunteered for that one, and we attached to 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines. And we went to Dalaram, Afghanistan first, and then we moved over to Sangin later in the deployment.
And what was the difference in the tempo between Iraq and Afghanistan? How did the mission differ? How did the level of risk differ?
They were actually pretty similar. Dalaram wasn't particularly kinetic in 2010. And so the vast majority of that, our time there was spent, you know, doing a lot of the same stuff as in Iraq, just going on security patrols and working with the locals. But then when Sangin came around, when it came time to move over there, for us, it was, 180 degree different. We didn't really see any locals. And it was just, you know, combat. I don't want to say every day there was some shooting. But I wouldn't say it was, you know, a big pitched battle every day or anything. But the threat to us became, you know, much higher just from IEDs and then small arms fire and indirect fire and that kind of thing. So it was a total 180 degree difference.
And so what's going through your mind as things are picking up there?
I'm happy about it. Like I said, I joined the Marine Corps to fight. And so, you know, we're all kind of excited and just excited to put our training to use and, kill some bad guys. That's what everybody wanted to do. So Yeah, it was a lot of excitement and, you know, a little bit of fear about what could happen, but you kind of have to put that stuff aside. Otherwise, you're not going to really be all that effective.
Absolutely. And take us up to the day when your injuries occurred.
So the way I was working in Sangin was we were taking over from the British, and basically what was going on was we had Fob Inkerman was pretty much the only territory that the British had. And so it was like Fob Inkerman would be, you know, British colors, and then everything surrounding it would be Taliban colors. And so what we needed to do was to start taking over Taliban country, taking over Taliban territory. And we had intelligence that they were these series of IED belts, basically, that just kind of areas that were reported to have a lot of IEDs in them. So we would get ready to go, and then we would launch these line charges from assault breacher vehicles, and they'd be just a long 90-meter line of C4, and then that C4 would explode and then sympathetically detonate any kind of IEDs that were underneath of it. And then they would follow that with mine rakes and mine plows, and they would plow up the ground and just clear out a path for us to get through the IED belts. And so after they cleared that path, then we would just kind of walk through. And then once we got on the other side of the IED belts, we would start taking over compounds. And so what combat engineers would do for that would be the grunts would set up security, and then we would kind of go in and sweep and make sure that the compound was totally clear of any booby traps or IEDs that might be in there. So we would do that and then take over the compounds and then do some security patrols while we kind of get reset, resupply, and kind of move everything to where we needed to be moved, and then repeat that. And so on that second time, I was actually a part of a squad that was providing security for the vehicle column that was doing the clearing and just protecting it from ambushes, that kind of stuff. And so at one point during the day, we sat down for a little, take a little break and eat some food and kind of, you know, just take a little rest. And then after that was done, our point man kind of let us off, and he stepped on an IED. And so luckily the IED malfunctioned and nobody was hurt. The blasting cap just went off. So the way an IED will work is that the pressure plate will be attached to a battery and a blasting cap, and the blasting cap will be stuck into a larger charge. So the blasting cap, the battery supplies the electricity to the blasting cap, which blows up the blasting cap, which blows up the larger charge. Mm-hmm. And so somewhere in there, the blasting cap and the main charge had enough disconnect that all that happened was the blasting cap went off. But the Taliban would emplace their IEDs in clusters. So they'd have a primary one, and they'd have a secondary and a tertiary sometimes, so that anybody coming over to rescue the person that got hit by the first one would hit the second one or the third one or whichever one. And so therefore that area then immediately became a danger area because there was a high likelihood that they were going to have another one in there. And so I started walking us through that area in the way that I do with clearing a route. And lo and behold, there was a second one. I didn't see it, and it hit me, and that resulted in double above knee amputations.
So at this point, you get injured, you lose both of your legs above the knee, and your life is pretty much changed at that point. And you have this thing happen to you. What were you thinking at that point? What was going through your head?
You know, I kind of assumed right away, you know, at sight of injury, that I was going to have to live in a wheelchair. I was going to have to be taken care of for the rest of my life. I wasn't going to be able to do the things that I enjoyed before. So, you know, I was pretty bummed out, you know, on the sight of injury. But then once I woke up and kind of got my senses, I was able to kind of recalibrate and actually learn a few things about what it was like to be an amputee. So then I could actually make an informed opinion about what that would be like. You know, my opinion outside of injury was naive and, you know, totally ignorant of any kind of knowledge about life as a disabled person. So, I turned that around pretty quickly. And even if I hadn't have learned that stuff, I think I still would have turned it around because, like you were saying before, you know, it's not a matter of what happened. It's a matter of what you're going to do. So I just had to determine that.
Was there like a single thing that kind of turned it around in your head? Was there an event, a person that you met or anything like that?
I have to say it wasn't. I think, you know, after I had a few days to really process and think about it, I just kind of realized that while I may be an amputee now, and that wasn't exactly what I had intended, and it wasn't exactly what I would choose, I couldn't really see how my mission for my life had been altered at all. In the broad sense, I still wanted to make a difference in the world. I still wanted to have an enjoyable life. And so with those two things in mind, I just had to, all that really changed was how I was going to get there and, the circumstances from where I was starting. And so once I identified that, I just needed to find my new path.
That's, it's funny because I think a lot of us, you know, we're trying to define what that mission is. You know, we have this, when you're in the Marine Corps, you have a single mission, and life is pretty much straightforward for you, right? You know what you got to do. You don't even really have to worry much about what you're going to wear. But when you get out, a lot of times it's really hard to define that mission. I mean, you've got all these other things coming in. You've got other things to worry about. The civilian world seems to be a lot more complicated. What is your mission in how did you define it for yourself? Were you lying there in the bed and you said, you know what, I want to change my, or I want to refine my mission to be this, or did you see something going on out there in the world? And did you just say, you know what, my mission is going to be to help veterans? In how did that come about?
Well, you know, like I said, the overall mission, I think, for anybody's life is to make some kind of difference, in the world and to the people around them, and just have a life that they enjoy. So that's very, very broad, and I understand that. And so between being in the Marine Corps, that provides you with a certain path to that, and it's a pretty clear-cut path, like you said. And whereas when you go out to the civilian world, you're almost paralyzed by choice. There's so many different things, and unfortunately, you know, there's nobody out there that's really telling you, like in the Marine Corps, they just say, well, this is how we're going to do it because you're in the military and you're in the Marine Corps. And so they have their certain thing that they do. And so when you're in the civilian world, there's nobody that's going to come up to you and say, well, go over there and this is what you're going to do. This is your thing that you're going to do. You kind of have to decide that for yourself. So that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to stay open to new possibilities. I didn't have a particular path in mind that I was going to take. So I just kind of listened for, you know, opportunities and possibilities and pursued the ones that, you know, had interest to me, and then kind of saw where they went. And so, you know, and that's what took me to, you know, the Paralympics. And that's what took me to, from the Paralympics, I went to the bike ride. And from the bike ride, I went to the marathon challenge. And so they all kind of just came together. But it was all just a matter of staying open to possibilities. And then, you know, when something came, I, you know, explored it a little bit. And then, you know, I found my path through that.
What made you turn toward endurance? Because you've done some amazing things. I mean, you've ridden across the country from Maine to California, I think, on a bike through cold weather. you got in the Paralympics with rowing. You've run 31 marathons in 31 days. And those are some pretty amazing feats, even for somebody who has all their appendages and all of their limbs. What made you start to think of these types of tasks and these types of feats?
Well, I just like to read a lot of books, and the stories of people that did these incredibly challenging endurance tasks just always kind of it's always impressed me. I mean, I really considered it the epitome of athletics, you know, more than anything. You know, there's competition, and then there's doing stuff like, you know, climbing Mount Everest or, you know, trekking to the South or North Pole and just things like that. It's really, I just thought it was really cool and really impressive. So, and one of the things that the Marine Corps sets you up really well for is being able to endure stuff they want to have to do. And so I was kind of already pretty good at enduring things. So it just became kind of a natural transition to, you know, hop on my bike every day in the freezing cold and ride it 30 miles for 6 months. So, you know, I was already kind of used to doing things like that. And it was something that interested me. And so, you know, I just put those two talents that I had and those interests that I had and applied it to, you know, my mission and my community. And you know, that's kind of, I put all those things in the little mixer and this is what came out.
So did you have any, did you get any coaching as far as, how to do these things with, the prosthetics? Did you go undergo any training sessions or anything like that?
Not really. The running, I mean, basically they just kind of set you up with the running prosthetics and you kind of learn on your own. I mean, they did a couple of clinics with some accomplished double above knee amputees that came over for, you know, an afternoon, and he kind of gave us some tips. And I kind of watched videos of other people, to see if I could, you know, change my technique at all or anything, but it kind of like a dog that loses one of his legs. You know, he just kind of adapts the three-legged running gait to, you know, just through experience, he adapts to that three-legged running gait. And so it was kind of like that. I just kind of just started doing it and figured it out on my own. Now, I will say with the rowing, I got tons. That's a little bit different. You know, you have to learn an actual technique to become efficient. And I probably could have learned that eventually on my own. But it's a little bit more in depth, and I only had a certain amount of time. And so I had to really kind of make sure I got coaching, the right kind of coaching at the right time, so I didn't learn bad habits and then have to undo them. But the running and the cycling, I just watched a few videos of other people that had done it and, you know, just got out there and started it and, you know, kind of taught myself.
What was the first day like? The first day you were on the prosthetics and you were outside taking a jog. What was that like for you?
So the first time I actually took a jog would have been in the clinic, and they have this little harnessing system that's in an oval that goes around the entire clinic. A small little what looks like a running track, and maybe it's about 4 feet wide or something like that. And so they harness you into this system, and it kind of, as you run around, it supports you in this harness. So if you fall down, it kind of catches you before you hit the ground really hard. And so I actually learned to ride my bike in that, and I also learned to run on that. So the first day, I put the running prosthetics on, and I stood up and got used to the feeling. It's a totally different feeling of the running prosthetic versus the walking. And I just kind of, they're like, all right, well, see if you can run. I mean, there's no real way for an able-bodied person to tell you this is what you need to do in order to start running. You kind of just have to figure it out. And it's not too hard to figure out. You just kind of, you feel it. when you put them on. And so I just took those first few running steps and was very tired afterwards. And part of what you have to do is numb your stumps and, you know, get the physical strengths of your stumps change so that they're accustomed to the demands and the stresses that running puts on them. And so the first little bit, maybe month, couple months, I would I'd only be able to run, you know, really short distances as you'd expect. And then at the end of the day, my stumps would be just incredibly sore. And so, to the point sometimes where I couldn't even walk. I had to be carried somewhere one time.
Like a muscle soreness or painful,
I'm not sure, man. It was like something in my leg was swollen, and the leg socket was pushing on it. And so every time I put weight on that leg, it would push into that swollen spot, and it would just be incredibly painful. But you know, after, you know, a long, you know, I developed that, you know, adapted to it, my body adapted to it. And then, you know, after that, I was able to run for, you know, longer than I could really even want to.
Wow. Wow. And, so how long from that point to being in Maine and starting your journey across the country was there? How long, in between was that?
So first time I ran or rode a bike really would have been in 2011. And then, my bike ride started in 2013. So about 2 years.
So about 2 years. And during that point, you were just practicing, training and getting ready for things. And when did the idea come up to ride a bike across the country?
Well, during that time, I was actually training for rowing. So I did the Paralympics and then World Rowing Championships in 2012 and 2013. So I really didn't do a whole lot of practice on my bicycle leading up to it, or any kind of training really, because I had to focus, you know, every single day on rowing. But yeah, I just basically before I started my bike ride, I just kind of got everything into place in terms of supplies and my plan, and just made sure that my prosthetics, you know, fit correctly and comfortably. And then my brother and I drove up to Maine and we just started.
It's just that you've done so much where you got into the Paralympics, you rode across the country, and it's kind of like, I don't want to minimize one thing or the other because they're all absolutely amazing feats. I'm just like, in my mind, going across the country, going from Maine to California, I'm from New England myself. I'm like, that's got to be a hell of a trip, man.
It was.
So,
yeah, it was. It was cold, and you know, it's just. But you know, I decided I was going to do it, and so I just kind of chipped away at it day by day.
And so, what kind of preparations did you have to make? Did you have to think about supplies? Did you have a car chasing you and things like that, or did you?
Yeah. So I bought a used, maybe 200,000 miles on it, U-Haul box truck, 17 feet, and kind of retrofitted it for my brother and I to be able to camp in it. You know, it wasn't going to be any kind of luxury vehicle, luxury camping or anything, but we put some cots back there and had some sleeping bags and kind of lined the floor with carpet. And then, yeah, went to Costco and got a bunch of supplies, put them in there, and then we drove up, and then, you know, I just got some spare prosthetic parts and bike parts and stuff, and we just loaded it all up and drove up to Maine.
Wow. And was there any press behind this? Were you putting messages out there about your travels or anything like that?
Yeah, I had a team of people that would call ahead into towns that I was going to be coming through based on my maps, and yeah, they would alert the local press. They would alert local hotels. I actually didn't really sleep in the box truck all that much because we were so successful with getting hotels to put me and my brother up. So, But yeah, so there was some press with it. Eventually, in the end, we did get on the Today Show for a few minutes with a video and you know, Sports Illustrated and a couple different national news media. But there was a lot of media coverage in the towns that we went through.
Wow. And then, so that's the other thing. So it's about 2 years between when you started and when you got onto the under the bike. In between that, you did the Paralympics. And so about how long was that where you started training for the Paralympics and started getting into rowing?
I decided that I was interested in rowing in the Paralympics pretty much in the first couple of weeks after getting wounded. I was kind of looking for a way to get things back that I had lost. And so I wasn't sure what my body was going to be able to do now, whether or not I was going to be able to do a hard workout like I enjoyed doing in the gym. And so I started looking for different ways, you know, sports for disabled people, you know, found the Paralympics, then found rowing, then found a coach to teach me how to row, and then found a rowing partner, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And just led that into the Paralympics. Yeah, I actually forgot what the whole question was.
Yeah, about how long was it before you started training for the Paralympics?
I got interested in the Paralympics in those first couple of weeks, but I also realized I had to, I needed to do my recovery. I needed to learn how to use my prosthetics and do my recovery. Kind of, that was my first priority. And so once I got far enough in that, that I could kind of start taking on other things, you know, kind of learning new hobbies and figuring out kind of the advanced stuff. That's when I went down to learn how to row in the spring of, early spring of 2011. And then at that time, you know, I wasn't positive that I was going to start training for the Paralympics because I needed to find a rowing partner. And I didn't know if the national team would really even look at me and let me try out or whatever. And so I just started, you know, just doing it for fun. And then eventually it got to a point where my coach at the time and I, he found a rowing partner for me, and she came out and we rowed together, and it, you know, and things just kind of started snowballing from there. And then so when I went to, I was training, you know, probably 4 or 5 days a week at that point, maybe 3 times on the water and then 2 times in the clinic on the rowing machine. I convinced the physical therapist to let me bring in a rowing machine for me to train on. So at that point I was training 4 or 5 times a week, not knowing exactly whether or not I was going to go to the Paralympics or what was possible. But once I found that rowing partner and it came time for me to retire out of the Marine Corps, actually start moving on to the next thing, probably in December of 2011, you know, I called her up or spoke to her and I said, well, she was interested in the Paralympics as well. I was like, so, all right, do you want to do this, you know, full time, full commitment? And she said, yes. And so we found coaches down in Florida so we could train every day. And then, so we pretty much started in December of 2011. And then the Paralympics were in September 2012.
Wow. So a good 9 months of hard training there, 10 months actually. I'm a grunt, so my math is pretty off. Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, if we had had longer, you know, if we had had another year, we would have done a lot better. But it was a really short time period to start. You know, I was a total beginner and she was experienced and we had never rowed together. And, you know, usually with a rowing partner, you'd row at least for a year together before you even thought about going to the Olympics or the Paralympics. But, you know, in that 9 months or 10 months or whatever it was, you know, we were able to get good enough to get the bronze. So, you know, if we had another year, who knows what could have happened.
Wow. That's, and it must have just been an amazing feeling, you know, being there and representing your country in another way. And I got to go to the Olympics last year in Rio. Just watching the athletes and the pride and the absolute, just the amount of work they put in is absolutely amazing, both in the Olympics and the Paralympics. I went to see the Paralympic trials at it was the World Championships at UCLA this past year for sprinting. And, you know, the amount of work that they put into the preparation, just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, that's what it takes. It takes, total, absolute dedication to it. If you want to be competitive, if you want to be on the world stage or be the best, you have to train just about every day. And you have to make that your number one priority above all else.
What's your training consist of right now? So, and you just finished up your 31 marathons in 31 days, I think a month or two ago, and then or earlier this year. And obviously, you're heavily into endurance. What's your training schedule like?
Right now, I'm just having fun in the gym, you know, just lifting weights. That's really all I'm doing, a run from time to time. But as you know, right now, it's in the winter time here, so it's on the ground. I don't venture out on my running legs. It's too tricky, too risky that I might slip. And so, yeah, you know, right now I'm just kind of having fun. You know, I did the marathon challenge, and I ran just about every day for a year and a half. And so right now I'm just doing what I feel like doing. And then, you know, as I come up with a kind of a goal for myself, to go after, then I'll start kind of molding my training to fit that. But right now just lifting some weights, doing some pull-ups, that kind of stuff.
Hit those weights, get those gains, get the big biceps. Yeah. It's,
man.
I love training in the gym. I love weights. I love endurance. I mean, I love it all. I've done Spartan races and things like that. And it gets addictive, and you know, you seem like a guy who can just sit and not do anything. You know, you've got to be out there. You got to be doing some work. With this 31 now, and I'm very, very fascinated just by you as an individual and all these things you've done. This 31 marathons in 31 days. I know you've raised a whole lot of money for some great organizations out there, and I want to thank you for that. I think that's so awesome.
But my honor.
How did this idea come up? Where did you say, okay, I'm gonna do 31 marathons in 31 days?
So after the bike ride, I made an attempt to make the Paralympics again in 2016 for a triathlon, and unfortunately wasn't able to. But what I did learn with that failure was that I had a pretty decent talent for running, and I had, just to kind of mix up my training, I ran the Marine Corps Marathon just for fun. And you know, I didn't really even train for it. I just, all I was really doing was running 5Ks. Training for a 5K, because that's the distance I needed to do for the triathlon. And just kind of on a whim, I was like, well, I'll just try and run the Marine Corps this year. And, you know, I did it, and pretty, you know, decent time for a first timer, and without, you know, no formal, you know, marathon training. So I knew I could do the marathon distance. I knew I had a talent for running. And I was thinking of what my next goal could be for myself. And I kind of figured, well, what if I did another big challenge like the bike ride? And I said, all right, well, I can do the marathon. So what if I did, you know, just a bunch of marathons back to back? Because I had heard about other people that did similar things, you know, just from my own, you know, reading stories about like Iron Cowboy and Dean Karnassus and people like that, you know, that had done similar stuff. So I say, well, okay, well, I can do something like that. And then, you know, as a double above knee amputee veteran, it'll be, it'll have a pretty powerful effect. And I decided a month was probably a good length of time in terms of, you know, long enough that I would get some momentum and then be able to capitalize on it. And then short enough that, you know, people wouldn't get tired of hearing about it. So a month of marathons, and then I got 31 days as the longest month. And so I also wanted to get it in front of as many eyeballs as possible. So I wanted to do it in 31 major cities, you know, 31 of the most populous cities in the country. And that's how it was born.
And how great of a distance did you cover? I think you started in London, am I correct? Or
yeah, so first one was in London, and then second one was in Philadelphia, and then I kind of went counterclockwise. And total miles driven, well over 10,000. I don't know exactly how many, but it was a long trip. And then running wise, that would have been, it was like 812 miles or something of running.
Wow. So your typical schedule was literally you're doing a marathon, then you get a couple of minutes to recover, and then you're on the road.
Yeah. Wake up, run marathon, and then yeah, hit the road, like you said, and then get to the next place and kind of get set up. And then, you know, if I had interviews, I would do all those and talk to people that came out, you know, so it wouldn't be like, you know, immediately leave once I finished the marathon. I'd stick around and talk to people. But yeah, then just recover in the RV, eat, sleep, get massages, that kind of stuff while we drove to the next place, and then repeat the next day.
Were you doing any like cold exposure or ice baths or anything like that?
No, we weren't really set up for that. All I really did was just eat enough food, make sure I got enough sleep. And then my mom is a massage therapist, so she came and along with us, and she gave me 1 to 2 massages every day.
You're getting me psyched up right now. There's no way I'm going through this day without running 5 miles.
All right, awesome.
That's just hardcore, man. What were you eating? Did you follow any kind of special nutrition or anything like that?
I ate, so I trained on pretty low carb. I realized, and so most of my training for the 18 months leading up was probably 50 to 75 grams a day of carbs. And then, just trying to develop that fat adaptation. Mm-hmm. Because I was also doing Maffetone method to train, and I wasn't going to take my heart rate over my aerobic threshold. So I was kind of coupling that together with the diet, and so optimizing that fat burning platform and that endurance platform, aerobic platform. So I kind of kept those two things hand in hand. And so, but I realized at the same time that I didn't think 50 to 75 grams a day during the actual event was going to be enough. So I usually ended up eating 150 to 175 grams of carbs a day. And that would just come from, I would eat a super dense meat sauce, meat and cheese sauce, I would usually pour over a bag of pork rinds. And then, so I would eat that, and then I would have, you know, bananas, sweet potato chips, and people brought us pastries. I'd probably have some pastries, you know, I'd have a donut or something if somebody brought us some donuts. And then I would eat a lot of eggs and a lot of, bacon or just other kinds of meat for dinner, lots of salt. And then, another bag of pork rinds somewhere in there. So it'd be a lot of stuff. And it was probably about as hard to eat all that stuff as it was to run all those miles. I mean, it was a struggle to cram down all that food.
Yeah. Just for the audience out there, cause we've got some people who are real curious about nutrition. The Maffetone method was developed by a guy named Phil Maffetone. Back in like the 1990s, all these triathletes, they were suffering from like crazy injuries. A lot of them were dropping dead from heart attacks, and a lot of them were having really, really big issues as far as their bodies just breaking down completely. And what this gentleman discovered, he was actually a chiropractor, but he had a real interest in this stuff and he had a good approach, was that if you increase the level of fat intake you're eating and you start to fat adapt, you start to decrease the risk of injury and you start to decrease the risk of heart problems and things like that by lowering the amount of inflammation. And so that's kind of what we're talking about here. I talk a lot. I have two types of people who listen to the show and read my stuff. I got nutrition people who are into ketosis. Then I got the Marines out there who are anytime I mention ketosis or low carb, they're like, shut the fuck up. So,
yeah, you know, it's, well, obviously it can be kind of a cult following at this yeah. point, but you know, I just decided to see if it worked for me, and it you know, obviously I finished it, so it did. And then, yeah, the Maffetone method is all just about training cardiovascular efficiency. So you just run under your maximum aerobic heart rate, and you start out pretty slow. But then if you keep doing that, your heart and lungs just become more and more efficient, and you end up being faster, but at that same heart rate. And so that's the theory that I trained on. And then I ran all my marathons under 150 beats per minute on my heart rate.
That's awesome. So obviously there was probably some super high points during this and some super low points. What was the hardest thing to get through during that whole 31 days?
The hardest single day was in Houston, because it was very hot and humid, and that's one thing that does tend to give me some problems. Because I run hot to begin with, and then I don't dissipate heat as easily, because I have less, you know, surface area of skin, and then it's encased in carbon fiber, so I don't sweat as much, or my sweat can't dissolve. So that was probably the toughest single day. But then the hardest period was probably after Nashville, which was my fifth to last marathon. It had been raining, and I slipped on this wooden bridge and injured my back somehow. And so for my remaining four marathons, which were Atlanta, Charlotte, Baltimore, and DC, just about every time I landed on my right foot, I had a pretty bad pain in my lower back. And so that was pretty tough to have to deal with. You know, it really took it out of me. But, you know, I got through it because there were so many people there supporting me on all four of those marathons. And, you know, I was close to the end, and I was doing it for fellow veterans. And, you know, I was just kind of figured, you know, that mission is so much more important than whether feeling some pain. So I just have to get to it and just endure it. And I did.
Yeah, you were raising money for the Semper Fi Fund, I believe, and a few other organizations.
Yeah, I raised money for the Semper Fi Fund, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation, the Coalition to Salute America's Heroes, and they're all just you know, charities that I believe in. I know the people that run them personally, and I endorse them, and they all have their own way of just helping veterans that have been wounded get out from underneath some of the more challenging aspects of being wounded and find their new path and then get back on their feet and, you know, make their difference in the world.
Awesome. Awesome. Couple more questions, man. You know, now that you're done with this, I know you're taking some time to focus on yourself and to start to get into some new things. I heard you're starting to read a bit. What are you reading right now? Mm-hmm. What types of books?
You know, I've always read, but right now I'm reading a book that was recommended by General Mattis called Earning the Rockies, just about the geography of America and how that led to, you know, our power in America. And then I read Tribe by Sebastian Younger recently.
I just finished that.
And I'm also reading... I'm also reading a few books about founding fathers. So I just kind of read stuff that interests me and stuff that I might be able to use later in life.
That's cool. Yeah, Tribe's a great book. I just finished that up, and it's got some great perspective in there. What's the next thing for you? What are you looking to do now?
I don't know exactly. Hopefully representing the positive way and trying to get my personal story out there and hopefully, you know, be an example of what veterans can do, what wounded veterans can do, and in that way continue to fight for other veterans. And so how that's manifesting itself right now is just from doing speaking engagements. And so, you know, running my mouth instead of running my body and spreading my message that way, just getting it out to as many people as I can. I don't know if I'll do another major challenge like the marathons. I would really have to sit down and think of something that would be, you know, equal to that. And that's going to be hard to do. So I don't know if I'll do another one like that. But I will continue to somehow fight for veterans. Whether that's with another physical challenge or keep doing the speaking engagements, or maybe I'll run for office in some capacity, or I don't know exactly yet, but I'm going to keep fighting for them. So that's the main thing.
Awesome. And we've got a lot of veterans listening to this right now, or when it gets posted, a lot of them Marines. What's your message to those guys who are sitting at home right now, and maybe they're wondering about the direction of their lives, and maybe they're wondering about where they're going to go next? What's your message for them?
You just kind of have to stay open to possibilities, and then experiment with them and follow them for a little bit and see where it takes you. You know, I just kind of stayed open to sports, you know, and I found the Paralympics, and I kind of started training for it without knowing exactly what was going to happen with it. And, you know, doors, because I did that, and other doors opened, and then because I followed those doors, other ones opened. So you just kind of have to pick something that you think might be good, or, you know, might help you out with your mission, and then follow it. But and sometimes it might end up, you know, a dead end, and you just pick something else. But you just have to remember your mission, you know, just because one something gets in your way, you know, you're a warrior, and so you don't let that stop you. That's in your blood. That's going to be with you forever. So don't forget about that.
Awesome words. Awesome words. Well, Rob, I really want to thank you. One, I want to thank you for your service. Two, I want to thank you for continuing to serve even after your military career by everything you're doing through your message, through your acts. And three, I want to thank you for coming on to the show. So, seriously, it's been a great pleasure and a great honor to speak to you today.
Oh, you know, it's been my honor as well. And, you know, thank you for the same thing. I appreciate what you're doing. And, yeah, I was just happy to be here, and I thank you for letting me, spread my message, tell my story some more.
Absolutely. And for everybody at home, I want to thank you guys for listening. And, you know, you heard the man. Get out there, keep moving, keep fighting, continue your mission, and get out there and live your best lives.